And I would like to tell you a little bit about my background and the denomination from which I came as a young man. My grandparents immigrated from Sweden. They were involved in the revivals that occurred in Sweden and came to know Jesus Christ during this revivalistic movement. They then came and immigrated to Chicago and became part of the Evangelical Covenant Swedish, the original name was Evangelical Swedish Covenant Church. My grandparents were involved in building a church in the neighborhood in Chicago where we grew up. And so I had two generations of church heritage when I came on the scene. And they were very anxious that I become a member of this church in good standing. However, something had happened during those years that followed since those original revivals. The first generation after those revivals had been evangelistic, and the gospel had been preached. But now I was the next generation, and the gospel was kind of forgotten in the next generation, but something else was forgotten. No one took the time to ask the question, why do we believe what we believe? What, in fact, is God doing in our midst? No one ever asked the question that I think the theologian needs to ask. What, in fact, is God actually doing in this world? What is His will? And as a result, they forgot their purpose. So as a young college student, I became very dissatisfied. I'd heard the gospel. In fact, I probably made a commitment to Christ as a youngster, but it had no meaning in my life. I really didn't know why I had come to faith in Christ. What in the world was God doing, really? And I asked my parents, and they said, well, if you had only been here 10 years ago, they were preaching the gospel in that day. If you had only been here 25 years ago and seen all of the works of God that were happening in our midst, but unfortunately I wasn't there 25 years ago. Unfortunately I had not been there 10 years ago. And they really didn't have an answer to this question. What was God's will for this church in that day? And as a result, today, the people in that church have answered that question themselves. They have answered the question in such a way as they wish to answer it. And today, the church basically has found its purpose apart from the gospel. There are many good churches in the denomination, but there are also a number that have departed. It seems to me that every generation needs to ask this question. Now, I'm not suggesting that we all, in fact, I don't want us all to go into the library and stay in the musty halls. That's not where we need to be. But I do think each of us needs to think through this question. What on earth is God's will? What is His purpose for you and for me today? And I believe that this is what Paul is directing the Colossians to do in chapter 1. When he prays in chapter 1 and verse 9 that they might be filled with the knowledge of His will. What he is suggesting is this. The same word that is used in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 18, be not drunk with wine, but be filled with the Holy Spirit. That same word is used here. And the same concept is present in both places. Our thinking, our vision in our generation needs to be directed by a concept of what God's will is for our generation. Now, I asked you last night to try to phrase it in a few sentences. And I'd be interested in how you did phrase it. What is God's will for today? Now, I teach a Sunday school class in Dallas, in our local church in Arlington, and it's not quite this large, but it is large, and most of the folks are very reluctant to say anything. They sometimes venture to say something if they sit in the front row. But but no one ever ventures to say anything if they're sitting as far back as Gordon is. They would never venture to say anything. What do you think? How would you find? Well, how would you state? What is God's will?
John 6:45 says it's pretty red.
Okay, what does it say?
It says, this is the will of God, to believe on him who he
has. Okay, very good. That's clear. This is the will of God, that you believe on him who he hath sent. Good. And that's a concise and direct statement. Excellent. Who else?
Give thanks in all things.
Give thanks in all things. Hey, that's good. Because this is the point around which Paul's thinking turns to, giving thanksgiving. It also turns around belief in Christ. Anyone else? Yes. Being conformed to the image of Christ. All right, let's compare these. And your suggestion is, well, I know that you have a suggestion. After Sunday school, people come up and they say, you know, we wanted to say something. And when you asked us the question, at least we thought of something in here. We may not have said anything, but we wanted to. And I know that it's difficult with a group this large for you to venture to say very much, but all of these suggestions have been excellent. Now let's compare them with what Paul is suggesting. I think Paul is saying that in spite of the fact that I am in jail, in spite of the fact that in your day there are pressures from the world around you, still God is at work. And God's will is being accomplished. I think he is saying that rather than thinking as a businessman and thinking, now how would a businessman solve this problem today? Or rather than thinking as a housewife, how would a housewife solve this problem today? I think he is saying, I want you to be filled with the knowledge of his will. So that you approach the question this way. How would a Christian solve this problem? And that be your first thought. Now he begins to develop this beginning in verse 12. And I'd like to read verse 12 and then I'd like some help from you. This passage is a very difficult one to discern. And it's going to be a difficult section to study because it's so involved and so intricate. It involves theology. It involves an understanding of God's will. So I want some help from you. I hope that all of you, well, maybe not all of you, but many of you have the new ASV. That helps somewhat because it identifies some of the pronouns in a clearer fashion. But if you don't, if you have the King James, that also will be, it'll also be possible to trace the pronouns. So I'm going to ask you as I come to each verse who these pronouns refer to. Verse 12, giving thanks. And this is where this one suggestion is very appropriate. Paul says, if we know his will, we will give thanks to the Father. For we recognize that the Father is the source of it all. The Father who qualified us to have a share in the inheritance of the saints in light. For he, who's that he? God the Father. For he delivered us from the dominion of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son. In whom, who's that whom? The Son, we have redemption. That is, the forgiveness of sins. And he, now the King James is a little different here. But the New ASV translates it, and he, and who's that he? Jesus Christ, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for in him all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. I think the key to verse 16 is to recognize those three prepositions at the beginning, in him, and then at the end, through him, for him. And verse 17, and he, who is that? Christ, is before all things, and in him, again another preposition, in him all things hold together. He is also, verse 18, the head of the body. So what are we seeing developed? The first he in verse 13 is God. The second he in verse 15 is Christ. He is. In verse 18, it is adding a second fact about him. He is also head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he himself might come to have first place in everything. For it was the Father's good pleasure for all the fullness to dwell in him, and through him to reconcile all things to himself, having made peace through the blood of his cross. Through him, I say, whether things on earth or things in heaven. And although you were formerly alienated and hostile in mind, engaged in evil deeds, yet he has now reconciled you. What new subject is introduced in verse 21? You. Us. First it's God, then it's Christ, and then it's us. And you were formerly alienated and hostile in mind, engaged in evil deeds, yet he now reconciled you in his fleshly body through death in order to present you before him holy and blameless and beyond reproach. Here's an interesting phrase. If indeed you continue in the faith, firmly established and steadfast, not moved away from the hope of the gospel that you have heard, which was proclaimed in all the creation under heaven, of which I, Paul, was made a minister. Now that's the passage. It's a tough one, isn't it? What is Paul saying? What is he saying the will of God is? I would like to suggest, and for hopefully to help you, I would like to throw onto the projector that Paul is saying two things. First thing he is saying is found in verses 13 and 14. And the second thing he is saying is found in verses 15 through 23. Let's look at the first. The first major thing that God is doing in the world today is found in verse 13 and 14. God transfers us to his Son's kingdom through redemption. Now that's not very difficult, is it? I would like to look at the various parts of this. Those of you from a military background have no problem with being transferred. That's a very important term in the military, and it's a very important term in this passage. For we have been transferred from and transferred to. And we would like to look at where we have been transferred from, and then we'd like to look where we have been transferred to, and then on what basis we have gotten our transfer orders. Is it sufficient? Well, let's look at the first, because it's a very fascinating one. We have been transferred from the authority of darkness. I've changed the translation a little, because I think it is a better translation. If you have the New ASV, you will notice in verse 13, he delivered us from the domain of darkness. If you look in the margin next to that number one, you'll see that it's literally authority of darkness. And that's where we'd like to begin. I think it's very interesting that God recognizes, and that Paul recognizes, that the realm where we begin is a realm that is controlled by someone other than ourselves. Most men think really that they have a control on the destiny of their own lives. They're in control. They have an authority, and they have an element of determining where they're going. But Paul says that's not true. Actually, where you were formerly is best described as an authority of darkness. It is an authority active in the presence of darkness. I think that what this suggests is that this authority expresses itself by keeping its subjects in the dark. I'd like to suggest two references that might support this. Romans chapter 1, verse 21. What does God say about the Gentiles? He delivered them to a darkness of mind. Let me read it exactly. Romans chapter 1, verse 21. For even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. And this domain is controlled by keeping its subjects in the dark. Let me refer to another passage, Daniel chapter 10. You remember Daniel chapter 10? Daniel is praying. These are seminary students from Dallas Seminary. They remember these. They can pick out these. Daniel has been praying in the book of Daniel to know God's direction for his day. If you want to study a book about prayer, one of the most fascinating themes in the book of Daniel is Daniel praying. And in chapter 10, he is praying. And you know what happens? You know how long his prayer is delayed? How long?
3 days.
There's a difference of opinion in the great hall. Let's turn. Daniel chapter 10. The 3 is right. 3 weeks. That's right. You think you pray? You should have heard Daniel. In the 3rd year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, who was named Belteshazzar. And the message was true, and one of great conflict. And he understood the message and had an understanding of the vision. In those days, I, Daniel, had been mourning for 3 entire weeks, seeking an answer. And what it turns out to happen was that there was a spiritual struggle in the heavenlies. And Satan wanted to keep Daniel in the dark. He didn't want him to know reality as it really is. And you see, this is the kingdom from which we have been transferred. But let me take it just a step further. What is this domain like today? What is it like in our day? What is the hope of men around us? What is their will for the future? What is the domain of darkness really like in our day? Well, I would like to illustrate it from a number of illustrations. The first one, rather silly, but I think it's a clear example of the dreams of men today, at least children. I came into our home a couple of weeks ago, and the children were watching Superman. They've revived Superman series. If you read about it more recently, they're even coming out with Superman number 2. But there's something appealing about Superman because he combines two things that every man, every natural man wants. At least, There's a subconscious identity or identification with what Superman has. One is that he always wins. And right, what he feels is right, always wins. And he does this by overcoming natural weaknesses. This mild-mannered Clark Kent, who never had a strong moment in his life, jumps into a secret closet and becomes this Superman that overcomes human weakness to realize the dreams of every man, of combining the ideals of achieving what is right and overcoming the weaknesses of man. Now, all of us recognize the folly of this, but if you investigate some of the images that our Hollywood is playing with today, you'll discover that these images are very close to Superman. For instance, one of the films that has been, or one of the series that has been very popular on television this past year is Bionic Man. And now they've come out with Bionic Woman. Now, what is a Bionic Man? Isn't it an attempt for man to rebuild man and overcome the weaknesses that are inherent in man by putting in computerized arms and computerized legs and computerized eyes? Human weaknesses can be overcome, and the things that man has always wanted to achieve, the bionic man can achieve. I heard the story of a little boy that had been watching television about the bionic man. He had seen it so often that he came to believe that he was the bionic man. And so one day he was out in play and he saw a tree that was in his way that he wanted to remove, and he swung at it. Trouble was, it didn't remove. But we're trying to remake man in an image that will overcome his basic weaknesses and be able to achieve the ideals that we want. Now, there are other images coming out of Hollywood. One that I read about recently was a film entitled Audrey Rose. In this film, this young woman at the beginning of the film has an accident and dies, but her spirit leaves her body and is reincarnated in an infant in a hospital not far away. And through reincarnation, man's weaknesses can be overcome. Another possible dream of men. Or another film that recently played was entitled Demon Seed. In this, a computer helps a woman to conceive, and the child that is born is a demon. And the hope is that through this somehow demonic offspring, the problems of man can be solved. Now, this is Hollywood's dreams, but it's not very far from science. If you've been reading recently about the DNA experiments, have you been reading about them? Francis Schaeffer has, and he is included in his very helpful book, How Then Should We Live? Rather interesting studies that have been going on since 1968, and I would like to read about some of them. I'd like to read about a certain Professor Crick, Harvard, who wrote in his book In the Origin of the Genetic Code, 1968, Crick begins to spell nature with a capital N about halfway through the book. And in Of Molecules and Men, 1967, he refers to nature as she. In other words, he personalizes what by definition is impersonal, according to his own system. Why? Because he can't take the implications of impersonality. Because this kind of semantic mysticism gives relief to people caught in the web of impersonalism. By his own definition, Crick lives in an impersonal universe. But by the connotation of language he uses, Crick personalizes the impersonal universe and calls for a selection clever and says it will think. Such language takes pressure off, and people fail to understand what they read. Dr. Crick says that this scientific enterprise is governed by a basic religious stance, And while he recognizes that the particular stance he takes is anti-religious in conventional terms, it is a religious attitude because it is concerned with religious problems. Now, here's the religious problem. Later on, he quotes, "We all know, I think, or are beginning to realize, that the future is in our own hands, that we can, to some extent, do what we want." Now, what is happening at the moment? What is happening is that we know that with technology, we can make life easier for human beings. We can make changes. What we are really doing is learning to tinker with the system. But there is very little thinking at the fundamental level as to what sort of people we would like to have. What's he suggesting? Genetic engineering. The creation through science of the ideal man. The man that can solve our problems. And you see, this is the will of man today. This is the will of man in the society around us. They are members, as Paul refers to it, of an authority of darkness. They're groping, hoping somehow to solve their problems through man. But you know, there's two problems with what science is doing. One is that it's still man rebuilding man. And whatever he rebuilds, number two, will still be under the authority of Satan. And that's the exciting good news that Paul has to say. You see, we have been transferred out of this. And we've been transferred into a new kingdom. And that's what Paul says in verse 13b. He delivered us from the dominion of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of his beloved Son. And you see, it's in that kingdom where God's will is being worked out. It's in that realm that God is working. What is God working to do? What is he trying to accomplish in the kingdom of his dear Son? Well, that's what we'd like to look at in a moment. But let me remind you, if any of you have been in the military, let me remind you of your early days in the military. Maybe you got orders of transfer. And then sometime later, these orders came back and said they were wrong. Your transfer is not going through. What is the basis of our transfer? Well, the basis of our transfer is redemption. I would like us to think a little bit about redemption. What does it mean that we are redeemed? That we have been transferred on the basis of redemption? What does that mean? Well, I'd like to suggest that the best definition for redemption comes from the Old Testament. And I'd like to try to illustrate it for you. In Exodus chapter 15, the nation of Israel is celebrating their redemption. And there were three things that happened to the nation of Israel. First of all, they were under the power of darkness. In Exodus, this power was Egypt. The second thing was that God proclaimed his judgment on the power of darkness. What was that judgment? Well, it was death. Of the firstborn. By the way, I'd like to just stop here for a moment for a brief excursion. Do you know who was the evangelist of the Old Testament? Have you ever wondered who shared the good news in the Old Testament? I have. Who were the navigators of the Old Testament? Do you know where they were? The fathers. It was the father's responsibility to share the good news. Put yourself as the eldest son in a Jewish home. You're living in Egypt. You've been talking to the neighbors and you realize that the word has come that on the 12th of the month, the death angel is coming and it's going to visit every home in Egypt. By the way, this was the first plague in Egypt that was indiscriminate. Each other plague had been visited only on the Egyptians. This one was visited on every home. And you as the eldest son get the news. And the death angel is striking the eldest son of every family in Egypt. And you come to your dad and you say, Dad, what can we do? My life is at stake. And what does the dad say? Well, we sure can hope that the death angel misses. If you were the father, would you say that? What would you say? Well, you'd bring him the good news, wouldn't you? You'd say that God has offered deliverance through the provision of a substitute. You see, God said, if we were to kill this lamb and take the blood and put it on the doorpost, that God would pass over our house. Oh, Dad, do you really believe that'll work? You know, in the university, that kind of subjective revelation sure doesn't seem very strong. What would you answer as a father? We might say that, but I think I'd have a better word. What would you say? Son, God said so. You know, and I believe His word. Even though it doesn't seem like it's going to work, God said so. If you say so, Father, do you believe it, son? Do you believe it, Dad? Yeah, I believe it, son. I believe that God has given us a substitute. And since His blood has been applied to our house, God is going to pass over. The fathers were the evangelists. Dads, don't miss your opportunities. We were just chatting at dinner, and one of the families was commenting about how they had been raised. And really, religion was never very much discussed in their home. It was important, but it was a very private matter. I hope you don't make it that. Our relatives in Denmark said, you know, we're open-minded about this. We're giving our children the opportunity to decide for themselves. Well, fortunately, I don't give my children the opportunity to decide what food they eat. I suggest the food they should eat. Should I take any less interest in their well-being in not giving them an opportunity to share Christ? I mean, this is one of the most exciting privileges that a father can have. And I think in the Old Testament, that's exactly what the father's role was. Now, that's the example in the Old Testament. What's the New Testament parallel? What's the power of darkness under which we live? The dominion of darkness. What's the judgment that God has passed upon that dominion? What's the good news? God has provided a substitute. Christ. And you see, if anyone can say, your transfer orders are not accurate, I can say, yeah, but they came from the Father, and they're based on the Son. I can rest in that. Can't you? We have been transferred from the dominion of darkness, where men cannot see clearly what's going to happen. And we have been transferred into the kingdom of His dear Son. And God has a purpose in that kingdom. And that's what Paul is going to develop. And I'm going to suggest in a broad statement what that purpose is. Here's what I think God's will is in this passage. What the rest of you have stated are statements of God's will. But as I think Paul develops it here, I think this is what God is doing in our age. God is exalting His Son over the whole creation. Oh, thank you. That's what my wife usually does in Bible studies whenever it's wrong. She always gives me the hand signal. God is exalting His Son over creation as we have a share in this exaltation through reconciliation. What is the ministry of the navigators? What is the ministry? 2 Corinthians chapter 5. God has given us the ministry of reconciliation. So you see, you are in God's will in this ministry. But this is what God is doing in our age. And it's exciting to see how this develops and how Paul develops it. And I again would like to take each element. I would like to first look at God's exalting His Son over the whole creation. And then I would like to look at our share in that exaltation through reconciliation. First, let's look at God's exaltation of His Son. He is revealing to us in this section what He is doing. In verse 15 through verse 17, He is exalting His Son in the first creation. Let's read it. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in Him all things were created, both in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through Him, and for Him. And He is before all things. And in Him, all things hold together. Now let's look at it point by point. First of all, He is exalting His Son by revealing the Son's image. When men saw Christ, whose image did they see? God. I love John 1:18. We beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten, full of grace and truth. God is exalting His Son in revealing that He has God's image. Says it very clearly. He is the image of the invisible God. If we want to know what God is like, we see what He is like. But in addition to this, He shares a role in creation. And this passage, I think, often causes believers problems. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. What problem does it create? Christ was created. The first statement suggests that he was God. What do we know about God? He's always existed. Now, it's obvious, it seems to me, that these two interpretations cannot both be correct. If he is truly God, then how can he be created? What do we conclude, therefore? I think that our understanding of 15b is incorrect. When we understand that the statement, the firstborn of all creation, as suggesting that Christ was created, we are in error. The word firstborn is a very special word in the Bible. It can refer to first in time. It can also refer to first in rank. Now, which do you think this refers to? Rank. What was the privilege of the Jewish eldest son? What was he beyond all other sons? He had the right, the birthright. He was the heir, primarily. And therefore, I think that what this refers to is that he shares a role in creation. Not only is he God himself, but he is the heir of creation. Now, in what sense is he the heir? In what sense is he the heir of creation? Well, there are three words that are used in the next two verses which are very important and which I'd like you to help me think through. They're the three prepositions. Actually, there are four in 16 and 17. In him, all things were created. Both things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones, dominions, or rulers, or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. Let's try to think through. In him, through him, for him. I've heard so many things about the castle this today that let's use it as an illustration. In whose mind did this castle take shape? There was one clear answer. In General Palmer's. That's right. It took shape in his mind. He was the one to conceive of its form. He designed it, didn't he? He was the designer. Through whom did it take shape? You don't like to talk. I know you do like to talk. Now, that's not true. You just don't like to talk out loud here. That's right, the builder. For whom? The owner. For us. Great. The owner. It was designed for his occupancy and in God's foreordination for navigators. It's interesting that no one else could live in it but the colonel and navigators. But you see the pattern developing? The creation took form in Christ's mind. It was created through Christ, who spoke, and the world came into being. But more interestingly, it was designed for his occupancy. Does he presently occupy the earth? In the sense that he will in the future? No. It's still in the developing stages. You see, we know where it's going. Oh, the excitement that caught me when I first recognized this. I was in engineering. And I don't know if you've been in an engineering office and have understood the Friday afternoon stance. We have in engineering offices desks that are about this high. And Friday afternoon, many of the men would come in and they would get set sort of like this. And you knew that you couldn't bother them that afternoon. Do you know why? They'd had a couple too many that noon, celebrating the week was over. And so they just propped themselves, lest if their prop went out, they would fall. And we knew, who were junior in the firm, that we never talked to those men in that position. We'd wait till Monday morning. They just didn't have any reason for living. Every week was a blast, and then Monday morning came, and they'd be drinking coffee, and their eyes were blurry, and they really had no purpose. What an exciting opportunity when I first saw the Scripture and recognized that God had a plan, and it was designed for Christ's ultimate occupancy. But you know something else that's very interesting is found in verse 17. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. What does this suggest? I suppose the process is getting out of control, isn't it? Rush is just too much for Is it out of control? No. He is the project supervisor. He is the process controller. He is controlling the process from the creation to its realization. And each step along the way, he is controlling. For you see, the Son is the heir of this creation. But he's more than that. He is not only the heir of this creation. Paul goes on to suggest that he is the heir of the new creation. For God faced a real problem. And we face a real problem. There's a curse on the first creation. What is that curse? Death. Every animal that we see, no matter how cute, is going to die. Every one of us, unless Christ returns, is going to die. The first creation is under a curse. There is a need for a new creation. And it's this one that the Son has an equally significant role in. Verse 18 introduces it. And this is verses 18 to 20. Let me read it. He is also, and I would encourage you to notice the also. He is also, not only is he exalted in the first creation, but he is also exalted in the new creation. He is also head of the body, the church. He is the firstborn from the dead, so that he himself might come to have first place in everything. For it was the Father's good pleasure for all fullness to dwell in him, and through him to reconcile all things to himself, having made peace through the blood of his cross. Through him, I say, whether things on earth or things in heaven. He is the head of the new creation. There's a couple things I'd like you to notice in his being the head of the new creation. It's described in verse 18. He is the beginning of the new creation. He's the absolute first. One. To be part of this new creation. The reason is found in the next phrase. He is the firstborn from the dead. For you see, the curse that rests on the first creation has been removed by Christ. He passed through death into new life. Therefore, Paul can say that all fullness dwells in him. He is first in the first. He is first in the new. Paul draws it to a conclusion by talking about our share. And I would like to draw it to a conclusion in talking about our share too. For God exalts his Son, and we have a share. Our share in his exaltation through reconciliation. Let's just think our way through this, if we can. What share do you suppose his enemies are going to have in his exaltation? None. So man had a very basic problem. For you see, he was God's enemy. And God had to deal with that problem. What is the share of a friend? It's different than the share of a servant, isn't it? We have the share of a friend. We are his friend now, through reconciliation. And we have a share in his exaltation. It is the share of a friend. I would like to just look at the term reconciliation a moment. This is one of these theological words that I think we need to know. What does this mean?
Brought back.
Yes, brought back. Where were we? We were enemies. Do you realize how we were enemies? In the fall, what did Satan convince us of? We could be like God. And if we believe that we can be like God, then how do we view God? We don't need him. He's like us. But is he our friend? What is he? He's our enemy. He's our rival. He wants to be God, and we want to be God. Why do so often men say, I don't want to become a Christian because of what I have to give up? What are they saying? I want to be God. And Satan, by suggesting this lie, and we, by accepting that lie, became God's enemies. What happened in the cross? In the cross, we find one who said, I will be obedient, whatever the cost. Lord, may this cup pass from me, But not my will, but yours be done. And in that obedience, Christ made way for reconciliation. For the first man that ever lived after Adam was obedient. And we have now become his friends. We are now reconciled. We now share in his exaltation as friends. You know, there's more to it, though, than this passage talks about. What else do we enjoy? Not only do we enjoy the privilege of being his friends, what else do we enjoy? Sons! We are adopted as his sons. Romans 8 says we are co-heirs. Isn't this an exciting? Isn't it exciting what God is doing? But now Paul says, I want to make sure that you understand that you have the share as an obedient friend. And therefore in verses 21 through 23, he makes a point. And although you were formerly alienated and hostile in mind, engaged in evil deeds, yet now he has now reconciled you in his fleshly body through death in order to present you before him. Here is our share in his exaltation, holy, blameless, and beyond reproach, if indeed you continue. What does that "if indeed you continue" suggest? I think it suggests that there is the possibility that we may share as a disobedient friend. And Paul doesn't want that to happen. He wants us to share as an obedient friend. What do you think is going to happen when we get into the presence of the Father and in the presence of his exalted Son and we've been disobedient? I think the New Testament bears witness to the fact that there are going to be those who are going to experience less boldness in his presence. Those that have been walking with him, those that have been obedient to the Father and to his Son, when we step into his presence, are going to experience great boldness. The possibility is, however, that if you haven't been obedient, you're going to be there. But you may not experience the same degree of boldness. And Paul wants us to share as an obedient friend. Now, what is God's will for our age? Well, I believe that we can summarize it. And I promised you, how many words did I promise? 10? I'm not sure I made it. God's will, I believe, is this. God's will is this. In history, God exalts his Son. And that's what I believe he is doing today. Over all creation, an exaltation that we share as his redeemed friends. I think this is what God is doing in history. I believe God is exalting his Son. And we have an opportunity to share in that exaltation. How many words is it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. My wife always said I was wordy. But I wanted to include us, because I think Paul does. I think there are three things that he's saying. God exalts his Son over all creation. And that exaltation we can share in as redeemed.